For decades, Wilmington was a railroad town. That all began to change in 1960 when the Atlantic Coastline Railroad, which employed many people locally, moved its headquarters from the port city. That ushered in a decade or two of economic decline before the town finally began to recover and, later, thrive. Wilmington is a completely different place now, of course, and railroads are much less a part of it. If most of us notice them at all, it's probably when they tie up traffic. And while there's the occasional story about rail realignment of commercial train traffic, or the long-heralded possibility of a passenger train station in Wilmington, the biggest story to do with trains lately has been about turning a long unused railroad corridor downtown into a future rail trail for biking, walking, and other outdoor activities. But if you delve back into the history of local transportation, especially pre-World War II, trains are a huge part of it. This is Cape Fear and Earth, the podcast exploring the legends, historical oddities, and landmark stories of southeastern North Carolina. I'm your host, John Staten, and I'm a reporter with the Star News here in Wilmington, for a Gannett paper that's part of the USA Today network. A rail line connecting Wilmington and Southport, 30 miles down the Cape Fear River in Brunswick County, had been a dream for decades in the 19th century. But it didn't become a reality until 1907, when construction on the Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern Railroad, or WB&S, began. It took 4 years to build, and in 1911, following an appropriately large celebration, trains began to run. Carrying both freight and human cargo, the train cut what could be an hours-long boat ride to Southport down to an hour and a half, including stops in Bolivia and other Brunswick County hamlets. It wasn't part of the Atlantic coastline, but it did tie into it. By the late 1930s, however, with improved roads and the rise of the automobile, the WB&S was pretty much done. My guest today is Mark W. Koenig, the former director of the Wilmington Railroad Museum. In January, his first book, The Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern Railroad, was published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. In it, he uncovers the history of that long-forgotten railroad line. In this conversation, we'll talk about how the railroad got built, where traces of it still exist, and about what the daily operations of a small town so-called short line were like in the early days of the 20th century. Okay, so I'm sitting here in the Cape Fear Unearthed studio with Mark Koenig. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so Mark is the former director, 12 years, of the Wilmington Railroad Museum, 2007 to 2019.
That's correct.
And your first book is about trains, so tell me, you must love trains.
Well, yes, I've enjoyed the trains, and working at the museum, of course, you get more and more into how vital they were to developing the country, and also particularly here in Wilmington, what a central employer they were for many years for the city.
Yeah, the Atlantic Coastline Railroad was here for, you know, decades and decades, and it was a central part of life in the city, and your book kind of tells a side story of the ACL saga, right? I mean, like the Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern Railroad wasn't technically part of the ACL, but it kind of worked with it. How did that exactly work? Never was.
Wilmington, being a port city, was a terminus for a number of railroads that ran to the west and the northwest and up towards Jacksonville. But there was never a spur that ran down to Southport.
When
in the 1890s, when there was a lot of growth in railroads, what we might call speculative investors began to look at Southport as a way to get to develop like a coaling station and develop the coal fields in Kentucky, West Virginia, Eastern North Carolina, and run them to the coast to Southport, which was closer and had a lot of attractive features for that kind of facility, and even maybe reach even further inland to some of the great commodity markets in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and develop this huge port facility that would make everybody wealthy. It spurred development all along the line.
But then I get the sense that some of the other railroad companies maybe not that into that idea.
Well, they ran into a thing called the Great Panic of 1893, which had an echo in 1898.
Yeah.
But all told, there were over 20 different railroad companies that were chartered. A few of them actually managed to start a few structures here and there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until 1906 that a group of North Carolina investors decided to kind of piece together some of the fragments of the earlier work and make a more sensible route that was just a spur from Wilmington to Southport.
Yeah.
And in this way, they could transport some of the fish products that were being processed down in Southport up to the fertilizer factory in Navassa, as well as taking out lumber products throughout the central part of Brunswick County, which was largely undeveloped.
No, absolutely. And I mean, as you know, the Brunswick County we know and love today, it's a very different place than I'm guessing Brunswick County in the early 20th century.
There's a lot more farmland in Brunswick County nowadays, as well as suburban development than there was back then, where it was mostly forested.
Yeah, and so the idea was to have a line to get products back and forth between Wilmington and Southport and people, right? And you could ride it as a passenger.
Essentially, basically, local trade.
Yeah.
If you will, back and forth, as well as passenger service that would take people down to Southport, which was known for its salubrious breezes and healthful climate, friendly town. It was a quaint sort of southern fishing village.
And it still is. And,
it still is in many ways.
You know, it still has aspects of that. Well, let's talk about, and so when was the first, and so 1906 was the first year.
That's,
was it completed, or that was when it started to be built?
That's when the group started getting going. They bought an existing logging and lumber company at Town Creek and went about securing timber rights for tens of thousands of acres along a strip that's kind of surrounding Highway 17 today.
Yeah.
And then spun off that to a railroad enterprise, which would connect the fragments that have been developed so far. Some of them were like 20 years old.
Yeah, and so it started, and so...
And they laid the first spike, and the president's son drove the first spike.
Oh, really? Wow.
In 1907, and in 1911, when they completed, the president himself drove the final spike.
Wow, so it took them four years to build this.
4 years. It was slow work. I think it was probably small crews until they approached near the end of that period when they had a time deadline to get into Southport in order to satisfy performance requirements.
Wow, and that must have been some hot, hard, nasty work.
Hot, sloggy work, sure. I mean, you know, a path had been more or less surveyed out earlier, but it's one thing to kind of look on a map and see where the train's going to run. Quite another to clear the land and develop a right of way.
Yeah. So before, this is the day when no one had cars really. I mean, if you wanted to go down to, like, if you're in Wilmington and you wanted to get to Southport, you're probably taking a boat, riding a horse, or how are you getting there?
Well, Captain Harper's steamer was the most popular way to get there, but that was a few hours down and a few hours back.
Wow.
And plus it was dependent on tides and currents.
Right.
But there were roads, but it was all wagon sort of stuff. Yeah. Roads were nothing like what we have today. Very, very primitive.
Oh, wow.
Automobiles almost unheard of. So everything was wagons. It might take you, 5 hours to get to Wilmington from Southport.
That's amazing. And today, I can hop in my car right now and be there for 30 minutes or less. Depending on how fast I drive.
Relative blink of an eye.
Right, no.
I wouldn't try so that was 30 minutes.
That was a day, so that was a day trip, basically, going to Southport. So tell me a little bit about the route. So, say I was in Wilmington and I wanted to get, the railroads open in 1911 or 1912. I want to go down to Southport. How do I get there?
You would board the train for Southport. You could board the train here in Wilmington. take you across the bridge north of town through Navassa. There it would branch off and take you through what's now Leland.
Yeah.
And then the Landvale area, sometimes called El Paso.
Yeah.
Take you down across Town Creek, down towards Bolivia. And then it would turn across the what's the bottom of what's now Boiling Spring Lakes, and then into Southport from there. And you'd end up right at the Rhett and Moore Street.
Yeah, well,
which is just a couple blocks away from the business district.
Yeah, and that's where the terminus was at Moore Street. Okay, so and then it had stops all along the way. I mean, I know I had to stop in Bolivia, where there's multiple stops where you know.
There was a station in Bolivia and Town Creek, Winnebago, Town Creek, Brunswick, in there, that they were pretty close together. The one in Bolivia actually had a telephone.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man. Shake our hands and raise our eyebrows.
I was telling you before we sat down to talk, my grandfather grew up in Bolivia, and he was born in the 19-teens, and mm-hmm. he was telling my dad, he remembers how the train came through Bolivia, and that's probably how he would get, if you want to go to Wilmington, you'd probably hop on the train.
Yeah, and being just a single track down and back, there wasn't an awful lot of traffic, and operating rules were sometimes a little on a relaxed side.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there's one anecdote from oral histories that refers to a passenger somehow being overlooked when the train came through the station.
Yeah.
And so the engineer stopped the train a little while down the track, and backed up the train to pick up the passenger and continue on their way.
That's great. And well, and then, so, well, how did you get, first of all, I guess, when did you first become, because the railroad was dismantled around World War II or pre-World War II?
It had been in receivership since the early 1930s.
Yeah.
And basically winding down its business, settling debts, reorganizing.
Yeah.
They spun off a trucking company. Whatever passenger service remained at that time.
Yeah.
And by that time, there were roads.
Right.
Decent roads. Whatever little trickle of passenger service was accomplished through what they called a bus, basically a stretch,
right, yeah.
A stretch car that also carried the mail. By the end of the later 1930s, it was basically out of business as a rail line. And by 1943, all the remaining assets were sold to settle debts, and the everything was torn up.
Yeah. So you've got 80 plus years, this thing has not existed. So how did you first hear about it, and kind of how did you get interested in this? It's kind of, like I said, it's not, everyone thinks of the ACL and the big business of trains, but this is kind of a little, fascinating side business. So how did you kind of become find out about and become interested in this?
Well, one of my first hints of its existence came in a self-published pamphlet or booklet from one of our trustees who talked about ghost railroads. Rails to Weeds is the name of the Charles Kernan. And he had talked about the different rail lines that extended out of Wilmington but no longer exist, one of which was this short line.
Okay.
And so, okay, there's an awareness there. I became aware of a story about soldiers from Fort Caswell boarding the train in Southport, but the train couldn't get up enough power to get underway. So they had the soldiers jump off the train and give it a shove, and jump back on once you got a little momentum going.
Because it was like so loaded down with all the soldiers, or just whatever it had, it was like had a
little whatever,
trouble.
Whatever.
So it didn't have the strongest engines, maybe.
They didn't have the strongest engines to pull whatever trains they had.
Wow.
It was always secondhand equipment.
Yeah.
And this may have been something that was carryover from the old logging company days.
Okay. Yeah. And first of all, this thing has been gone for so long. How did you find out about it? How did you do the research? You mentioned to me that if you look on even Google Maps to this day, you can maybe see some of the old remnants of this thing.
Yeah, you can see the path.
The path
where it would have gone, the right of way. Well, little bits and pieces began to accumulate. Working at the Railroad Museum, I'd hear a little story here sometimes. The Star News actually did a few retrospectives on memories of the old Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern.
Oh, wow.
And it was able to pick up on those. In addition, the weekly newspaper in Southport,
yep.
The Stateport Pilot, ran a Remember When photo series.
Wow.
And a number of things that showed up in their newspaper talked about the station and the train. And there were a lot of, I would say, tail end of memories of this.
Yeah.
And getting into it a little bit further, later on, picked up more and more stories about it. The digital world, blessedly, has something called newspapers.com,
which is
digital reprints of all kinds of papers, and a lot of North Carolina papers have been digitized. So I was able to do searches in there and find an awful lot of information, not only about the Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern, but all the predecessor attempts that had gone into this.
Right, right, because you said this wasn't just something that sprung up overnight. There's been talked about doing this for years, if not decades.
Oh, over 20 years.
Yeah. Wow, and then so, at some point, what made you decide, you know, there's a book in this?
I began just basically compiling.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces, paragraphs, stories, beginning to say, okay, you know, this is beginning to have some legs.
Yeah.
Filling in the gaps, going out and doing some actual walking of where the train ran.
Yeah.
Picking up a little bit on the environment, and then running across some resources like Bill Reeves' compilation of newspaper articles, the history of Brunswick County in five volumes, mind you. A couple of oral histories that are at the UNCW library, and over a period of time, they've amassed quite a bit here until I ended up with two large ring binders full of research material plus more, and then the images, and tons of images there, and started a document, and you know that just grew and grew and grew until I had about 24,000 words involved.
That's great. Well, let's just, okay, so you mentioned that you went down there and you kind of walked some of the paths where the railroad was. What is it like today? And is there anything left that you've been able to kind of find that, you know, that points to it being there?
There are traces.
Yeah.
There are traces. Up at the north end in Leland, there's a little spur road off of old Fayetteville Road. It's called WBNS Road.
Oh, wow.
Okay, there's something. And you look on a map and it's lined up with Navassa Road.
Yeah.
Well, train ran across there. At the other side, there's Dove Way over in Landvale, which aligns end to end with WBNS Road.
Wow.
And then you get down towards Bolivia. There's McKay Road, which runs off the to the southeast of town, and that aligns with Ridge Road, which is an undeveloped road south of Boiling Spring Lakes, and that continues on. And you just kind of look at this stuff on a map and start knitting it together, connecting the dots, connecting the pieces, and supplement it with period maps, would show where the train ran, and you can kind of locate it fairly well.
Well, it's just so fascinating to me because it was just such a different time. You know, now we hop, just as you said before, we hop in our cars and we're there. It was getting somewhere back then was not, it was more of an undertaking, it sounds like. It's just more of a, you know, to get to Southport and back, maybe you could do it in a day. It'd be a long day.
For motor travel or road travel, yes. Now, it was a big deal that the WBNS was able to make the trip in an hour and a half or under 2 hours.
Yeah, so you could be, so you start in Wilmington, you're in Southport an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, what was the top of the good at, 25 miles an hour, maybe?
Well, okay, we're getting into dicey stuff here because the track bed was never a very robust construction.
Yeah.
They basically laid cross ties down on native grade and put the rails on top of it. Well, anybody who's driven around in Brunswick County realizes there's an awful lot of sand and shifting, ground down there. And speeds, I think, just got lower as time went on, as the tracks distorted a bit. And as the relaxed schedule allowed, acquired the nickname of the willing but slow. It wanted to get there, but, you know, it was moving on Southern Standard time. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, there you go.
And the other one was wobbles, bumps, and shakes, based on the nature of their track.
That's excellent. Well, now that you've written a book, now you've got one book under your belt, are you going to do another one?
Working on a possibility now of interesting... sort of an interesting character. There are some criminal exploits in there, and we'll have to see where it goes.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll check back with you when that happens. Mark Koenig, author of The Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern Railroad. It was released in January. You can get it. We'll have a link to it on our Facebook page and on the Star News website. Mark, thank you for sitting down with Cape Fear Unearthed.
Great. Thank you very much.
And that's it for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed and our look at the history of the Wilmington, Brunswick, and Southern Railroad. We'll be back soon with another chapter of Wilmington history. Till then, make sure you're a member of our Facebook group, where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own memories of the region's history. In that group, I post extra content from each episode and links to all my coverage of local history for the Star News. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. Don't forget to sign up for the Cape Fear Unearthed newsletter that goes out every Thursday. Sign up for the newsletter at starnewsonline.com/newsletters. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by yours truly, John Staten. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com. Additional editing for the show is done by Adam Fish. The podcast was made possible by listeners and readers like you. Support local journalism and Cape Fear Unearthed by subscribing to the Star News today at starnewsonline.com/subscribe. And you know what? While you're subscribing to things, be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream this show so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review, which will help more people find Cape Fear Unearthed. Till then, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. You never know what you might unearth.